Welcome to Get Down to College Business. We will identify strategies that could make the difference between keeping university doors open and closing them for good. I'm pulling in business experts and higher ed leaders to debate the merits of strategies that could save the future of higher ed. I'm your host, Sarah Holton, PhD. Let's get down to college business. Hi, everyone. This is Sarah Holton and your host. I'm joined today by Dr. Angela Walmsley, consultant and president of Interactive College Prep. She's been in the K-12 and higher ed circles for more than 30 years, although she looks much younger. And she's currently a professor of education. She's authored 5 books and more than 30 articles. And so she knows what she's talking about today. Welcome, Angela.
Thanks, Sarah. Nice to be here.
Most of my podcasts so far, they've been geared toward the audience of college leaders and faculty and people who are maybe at the administrative level. But today's topic is designed for another one of my audiences, which is students and their families. The college search process can be pretty daunting, and it probably feels like a part-time job when you're in the midst of that process. And today, Angela is going to break it down for us and give us her pro tips. Not only is she a consultant for students in the college search process, she's also a mother of 3. And so she's gone through this process multiple times with her children as well. Angela, let's start with the starting point for people who want to go to college. How do prospective students begin thinking about a college list when they're looking at an undergraduate degree?
That's a great question, Sarah. A question I get a lot of the time. I usually tell families, honestly, to start with geography, kind of how far away are you willing to go? Do you want to be drivable? Do you want to have to take a plane? And I usually give the classic example of it's Thanksgiving week, you're supposed to go home, your flight gets canceled because of weather, kind of what happens? Are you okay, you know, pivoting and maybe staying with a roommate? Are you okay with the situation? Or are you like absolutely devastated that you can't see your family? You know, because those things really do happen. So it's hard, I think, for kids when they're thinking about going away, because so many people just want to go away, but they don't think about the ramifications of what happens if I need to get home, or I want to go home a lot, which is okay too. So I usually say, you know, kind of start with geography. As you know, lots of kids go to college all over the US, and many people do fly and go from coast to coast and across the country. But really, the majority of kids actually still go kind of within driving distance. And when I say within driving distance, I mean like 6 or 8 hours, right? So it's not just necessarily a couple hours down the road. But I usually just say, you know, think about geography. The other thing that impacts that is the state university systems, right? A lot of families end up choosing a state university system or a college within it because often the tuition is cheaper. And so that's going to impact as well. Saying all that, you do have students who have particular interests, like they want to do like film studies, or they might want to do like journalism, you know, something that might be a little more specific. And maybe they have an institution or a couple in mind that are sort of known for that or who are really good at that. And so that's another kind of reason that somebody might move, you know, across the country for college. But those are sort of the things that I usually kind of ask students and their families to think about. And then you often also get the students who are like, I live in California and my mom went to college in Ohio, so I'm going to look at Ohio colleges as well. You know, so you have that aspect where maybe family has been before, or maybe they have a support network there. Maybe they have grandparents there or something like that. So I see that quite a lot as well. Families where the student might want to stay in their area, but yet they have this, you know, kind of random place outside that's further away, but it's because they have an external network there.
Sounds like family is really important driver of how students choose their colleges, whether they're going somewhere far away that has some extended family or whether they want to be within driving distance of their immediate family. So have you seen that family is really one of the biggest variables in this decision?
So I would say yes and no. Almost every student I work with tells me they want to to live away, right? Like live away, move far away. My own kids were the same. I want to go far away. And my answer is you can go to college in the same town and still have that experience of feeling like you're far away, in particular if you're living in a dorm. And so I think once they sort of realize that they're going to have this traditional college experience, and I should say that most of my students are traditional age and traditional college students. So they are looking at going to a four-year institution and, you know, completing their degree in 4 years, being a student first, and then, you know, not necessarily working other than maybe part-time. So that's one, I guess, one caveat that I should say. But the families really, I feel like, are influential because these students, again, because they're traditional, they're 18 years old, they don't necessarily have a lot of savings themselves, right? So the families are very involved in the cost of college and that whole dynamic and that whole discussion of what's worthwhile to pay for and what's not. I would say, you know, when most families and students start out, they sort of feel like, okay, I have this whole country, sometimes even further afield to pick from, like, what should I do? But in the end, I always tell people, please don't focus just on one, because in the end, often it literally comes down to cost. What's the best value? I always tell all of my students and families, the last thing I want is for them to have hundreds of thousands of dollars of debt for a four-year degree. And so cost is a really important factor. And you don't always know the cost until the end, till you get all of your offers and you can compare them. So that's why I think that family is really important. Most of my families, I would say, really have their student kind of lead the process as much as possible. But I always encourage them to talk about those things I mentioned before, geography, kind of how, you know, how are you going to get back and forth, and cost in the end.
Everyone is cost conscious, and the value for higher ed has to be there for a family. If they're going to put this kind of investment into it, they want to know they're going to get it back. Okay, so you kind of gave us a nice overview of how we get the general list going, like which schools am I going to target? Let's shift into the strategy for applications. Is this just a numbers game? You know, apply to a bunch of colleges to increase the odds of getting in? Or are there diminishing returns at a certain number of applications? What's your strategy that you advise your clients on?
Sometimes when students come to me, they'll say, I want to apply to like 25 schools or something like that. Like, I want it to be big. I want to like touch all kinds of areas and hope for the best. I actually think that's the wrong strategy. You want to be really strategic in what you do. And there's what we call safe, target, and reach schools. So you're going to have safe schools that, like, you're like literally almost positive you're going to get into. Then you're going to have target schools that those statistics kind of match your statistics. So, you know, the average freshman has your kind of test score, your kind of GPA, your kind of background. And then you have the reach schools. Those are the really selective schools, many of which kind of no one knows how you get into those. Those are the people, you know, that like those institutions have like an acceptance rate of like 10% or something like that. You know, everyone who's applying is awesome. And so you don't want like all of those. You want this balanced list. And you can have like a rock star student. And if they're only doing reach schools, they literally do have like the capability of not getting in anywhere, you know, because again, it's just so highly competitive. So I always say you want this balanced list. I usually recommend a public institution in your state, because again, often those end up being cost effective. Whether you end up going there or not, it's nice to have it kind of as a background. So in terms of sort of numbers, I usually have kids try to stick to sort of 10, I would say 10 or 12 or less. If you go for that concept of reach, safe, and target, you know, like 2, 2, and 2. So 2 reach, 2 safe, 2 target, that gets you 6 institutions. If you're totally positive of your safe school, you might just do 5. And I do have lots of clients who do that. My own kids only applied to like 4 or 5. And so you can do that. I think it's better to be strategic about what you want. Every once in a while, I'll get somebody who'll say, I want to apply to College X just to see if I can get in. But why apply if you're not going to go? You know, like just be strategic about what you want out of the college and don't apply unless you really think you're going to go, because that's an important decision. And if you get a spot and somebody else doesn't, and it's just kind of for fun for you, that's not really fair either, right? For others. So that's sort of my guidance, is to just try to be strategic. And then I also think that students who think they're going to apply to a lot, once they get down to it, realize it's a lot of work. You know, every institution that you apply to, even though we have a common application, is still a lot of work, because there's always extra questions and extra things to do. And so it's hard to apply to a lot. It's, I mean, you know yourself, Sarah, when you look at teenagers and high schoolers, they're extremely busy. And so it's trying to fit this in as well. And so if you can be really thoughtful about it and strategic about it, it makes it a little bit easier in the long run.
What's the average time for each school in the application?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't really know if I could answer that. So basically what you do is you spend a lot of time preparing for the common application. So that includes your essay, like your main essay, what's usually called a personal statement, and includes a pretty targeted activities list. It's got a lot of personal information. So you're kind of like prepping a lot of this stuff ahead of time. Then when the common application opens, which is August 1st each year, then you basically kind of put all of that in there. And that's when you can then go into the individual colleges within the same system and see what else is asked for those specific colleges. And for some, it's not very much, but for others, it's like multiple essays. So, you know, if you're going to an institution with multiple essays, you're definitely going to spend a couple more hours for sure, you know, for that and for that institution's application. And then it also depends on, you know, how much time you want to commit to it. So, you know, some kids will write an essay and not really do a lot with it and submit it, which is not my advice. You know, I'd rather that they work on it, give it some time, proofread it, go back to it, you know. And so having a couple weeks or months to do it is actually helpful, so that you don't end up doing anything too quick at kind of at the end.
So the common application is going to take the most preparation and thought. But then each school will have a variable amount of time, depending on how many essays, or if they have special programs, or like, say, honors program that they have to apply to separately, you might have extra essays there. But your suggestion is two safe, two target, and two reach schools. Did I get that right?
Right. Kind of as a minimum.
Even though you're not getting into the reach school.
You might. And when you do get in, you're like, wow, amazing, right? I would say, I'm trying to think of my current group this year, you know, a lot of them got into at least one of their reach schools. So that's good. That's really good.
What types of classes do you advise students to take while they're in high school, or if they're maybe even taking community college credits, that helps prepare them for this process of attaining an undergraduate degree? I could easily guess at dual credits and AP credits, but are there others?
Great question. So I actually get this question a lot. Like, should I fill my schedule with APs? Like, what should I do? So generally speaking, you've got your traditional high school curriculum. You typically have honors classes kind of early on that can be an option. And then when you move to advanced, you have AP, so advanced placement, IB, which is international baccalaureate. Some people do what's called like a Cambridge program, which is similar-ish to the IB program. And then you've got the dual enrollment or dual credit. And depending on the state, actually, a lot of states, it's sort of popular to do your associate's degree at the same time as your high school diploma. So it's kind of, you know, like a dual program. And so depending on where you are, like, you sort of do what's best for you. Now, what I tell people is that you want to push yourself as much as you can, but still get A's and B's. So like, if you're going to sign up for all AP classes and you're going to get a C in all of them because you can't do that level of rigor, then that wasn't a good choice for you. You should have been at the regular classes or the honors classes. And we all have different, you know, academic abilities. Not everyone's going to be able to do all APs and get A's in all of them. And so that's very much, you know, an individual student and family discussion of like, how many APs should I take? Should I do it at all? Because again, you're balancing like being successful, getting your A's and B's and having a good GPA, as well as, you know, the rigor, being exposed to the rigor that your school offers. When you talk to admissions counselors, the number one thing they say is that the rigor of the coursework is the most important. So if you're a super high-flying student and you're extremely academic, you're going to, you know, really do well on the test and you're going to do really well in all these harder classes, then that should be your track. And I would say that's probably not the average kid who goes to college. You know, the average kid who goes to college probably has, you know, a mixture. They're taking some traditional classes. They're maybe challenging themselves with a few APs, you know, in the fields or topics that they like. But to summarize, what you want to do is push yourself as much as you can, but in a way where you're still going to be successful.
So really the ultimate goal is your GPA.
Well, yes and no. It's your GPA in conjunction with what's offered at your school. So let's say you are a super high-flying student and you were like, I'm not going to take any hard classes because I want a perfect GPA. So I'm not going to take any APs because I want a perfect GPA. That person is not going to be looked as favorably as somebody who has like a 3.9 GPA, but they ended up pushing themselves with taking some harder classes.
Okay, so there's a intersection that you need to satisfy. You have to have a balance of rigorous courses while also maintaining that high GPA.
Right, exactly.
In the last few years, we've seen some colleges go test optional in the admissions decisions. And I know testing has kind of come and gone in the last few years. ACTs, SATs, some places they carry no weight or less weight. Should prospective students still spend time, effort, money to study and prep for those tests? Where are we right now?
So that's a great question. And the testing situation, like you said, has been debatable over recent years, for sure. And test prep is a huge market industry, right? Like lots of money goes into test prep. And so there's good and bad about all of it. So here's sort of what I would say. The testing kind of went, you know, along the wayside a little bit because of COVID. As you know, with the lockdowns and shutdowns, that many students actually couldn't take the test. I even talked to families where students were upset they couldn't take the test because they had prepped for it. And then, you know, they weren't allowed into the testing centers. So institutions, you know, were forced really to become test optional at that stage because of COVID. But I would tell you that some colleges, in particular, some of the smaller private colleges were actually test optional long before COVID. In particular, because maybe they were more about sort of the whole person and, you know, looking more holistically at their application. So some of them were test optional kind of all along. Another thing I would say about the testing is it very much depends on the state. So California is a very anti-testing state, whereas Florida requires testing for every institution that's a public institution when you apply. So, you know, you've got really the whole spectrum. And I feel like we really got away from testing. And if you've been following the news kind of recently, we see the trend for some of the Ivy League schools kind of pushing back towards going back towards testing. So kind of whether you believe in testing or not for the application, I encourage all of my students to do the test. I encourage them to do either the ACT or the SAT or both. But I always get the question, like, does a college want one over the other? That's not really true. You know, all the colleges that I've worked with, they'll take either one. I like the kids to take it because to me, it's just another metric. It's another metric in this puzzle, you know, equation of what's this candidate going to look like when they apply. And then they can decide whether to submit it or not. That's the other thing. You know, you can take the test and kind of see how you're going to do. And then if it's a test optional school, you can decide not to submit it. And I have lots of students who do that. But the other thing about testing that people don't tell you is that a lot of times scholarships, including scholarships from the university, are not awarded unless you've submitted a test score. And so an institution may say you don't have to submit a test score for application or admission, but you do if you want to be considered for scholarships. So a lot of people don't know that. So I always like to sort of say that.
I actually didn't realize that either. And I'm guessing some of your clients have been blindsided.
Right. And a lot of times I have parents who will say to me, my student doesn't need to do the test, right? Because really that's what is sort of being advertised. Like, you don't really need to do the test. In particular, like I said, on the West Coast, we see that a lot, not wanting to do the test or not using it for application. And so they don't think that their student needs to necessarily do it. But I think it's really worth it because I think it'll help with scholarships. The other thing that some of the institutions are doing is they're placing you into your freshman classes based on the test. So kind of using it, as a placement test instead. So I think there's real advantages to do it. I understand that not everybody is a test person. Lots of kids aren't good test takers. A couple of my own kids aren't good test takers. I totally get it. But I do think that the tests have been valid and reliable for a long time. And so, to have that, again, just as like one extra piece in the equation is actually pretty helpful. The other thing that tests have done since many of the parents have been to school is they do what's called super scoring now. So you can take the test multiple times and they'll take the highest score from each subsection and create a super score. So that's really a nice thing too. If, a student had took the test and they had an off day in one subject and then they want to try it again and they do really well, then it's going to super score. So that's, and not all universities super score, but most of them do. And again, if you're doing anything for scholarships, often the super score is what is used. So that can be helpful as well. But like I said, I know that test prep is a big industry. And so should families spend, thousands of dollars on a test prep course? Not necessarily. They can do lots of things themselves. And sometimes it's just helpful to have the score. And I'll even work with families that way. Like if they take the test and, it's particularly low, I might make a suggestion about going test optional, or it can change your college list a little bit, if you decide early on that you want to be test optional.
You mentioned that test prep is a big business. You mentioned you could spend thousands. Are you seeing families spend thousands?
I would say if you do a full course, you could definitely. Some of the national courses, there's a lot of option with test prep. Some are like subsidized through your school district. Some are free school district or a library, all the way. And some families spend quite a lot on private tutoring because they find that more. And one of those, let's say you have then by putting that money and time into test prep, it could mean that they get substantial scholarship money, even from an institution. So, if you're going to spend $1,500 on a test prep course, but your student's going to spend $1,000 a year because you scored so high, it was worth the investment.
So, Angela, you've obviously had to research a lot of colleges as part of helping your clients through this process. Tell us some examples of what colleges do to help prospective students move through the process easily. And then I also want to hear the opposite. I want to hear about the barriers they create.
Awesome. Great question. So firstly, what I would say is that institutions have a team of admissions counselors that are available for students who are interested in the university. And they're really great at answering questions and being available. And so I always encourage families, use the admissions counselors to your benefit. Reach out to them, ask questions, visit the campus, ask about the culture. And most admissions counselors I hear from say that they really love working with the students and getting to know them. So I think that support's really good. The thing that comes to mind in terms of the barrier is one thing I've even seen myself is kind of the lack of campus tours that are available and kind of off times. So a lot of families want to go over breaks, holidays, weekends, and that's often when they're not offered. And so one thing that I think would be more helpful is if institutions could do some of those in-person events, in sort of those off times. And then the other thing that I would say that isn't about admissions, but it's once you are accepted, is that some institutions are getting creative and offering different things than what the student applied for. So they may offer like a summer start or a spring start. They may offer an online only program for freshman year. And so sometimes that's just a little confusing for students and families because it wasn't even something that was on their radar. And so whether that's good or bad, maybe just an explanation that could end up being your option without you even knowing it.
So speaking of being confused, this post-COVID generation has us college leaders a bit confused about what this next cohort wants out of their college experience. What do you want, particularly the admissions and enrollment leaders, what do you want them to know about this next cohort of students?
So one thing that I think is important and related to what we talked about before is the money aspect. They want to know that it was worthwhile to invest in a college education and that there's a return on their investment. And while most students and families understand it's a traditional college experience, they want a job at the end of it. And so I would say that, you know, focusing more on, you know, support for career services afterwards, or even things like taking a look at your core. I've seen some institutions change their core classes to be more applied or more, you know, sort of job 21st century skills savvy. And so that's one thing that I think is really going to be a push as we as a country weigh this whole, you know, is it worth the money to go to college question. The other thing that I would tell you is that not all of them want to do everything online. There's this, you know, thought that all these young people are so good at doing everything online, and in particular because, you know, they lived through COVID in an online world. But so many of my students want to be in person and in classrooms versus online. And I think that institutions need to realize that. Some institutions have certain classes that are only online, even if you're living in a dorm. And so sort of as a parent, that wouldn't make sense to me that I was paying for my student to live in a dorm to do online classes. You know, it just doesn't add up. And so I think that while online can be good for some people and some situations, the traditional student really wants that in person as much as possible.
I could see how that would be surprising to some leaders, right? Especially this post-COVID generation. Don't they all want everything online? Do you get any other really surprising insights or questions from your clients?
One thing that I'm always amazed in general is so many students and families feel like their students should be able to go to college for free. So we hear this all the time, right? Like somebody's going to get a free ride because of X, Y, and Z, or an athlete's going to get a free ride, or somebody who's really top-notch academic's going to get a free ride. In reality, there are really very few free rides to college. Even if you would get a fantastic tuition scholarship, you probably still have other expenses, or you might have, you know, room and board expenses. So while there are good ways to find money for college, I think that every family should be aware that there's an expectation that they're going to have to help somehow, whether it's help get loans or help fund the college experience. And so I'm always amazed a little bit about how much people think that is kind of out there for free. And you'll hear things about scholarships, like, you know, that you could go for free if you apply for all these different scholarships out of a scholarship database. I once heard a scholarship database administrator say that you needed to apply for like 3 scholarships a day to get enough scholarships to go for free. And again, you know, what student's going to have time for that? And so that's the thing I would say that sticks out in my mind is, in general, sometimes people aren't totally aware of really the cost, the true cost.
Okay, speaking of costs and financially affording college, the new FAFSA launch is an absolute disaster this year. That is no secret to anyone. It's causing significant delays in colleges being able to put together financial aid packages for their students. How are you seeing the FAFSA issues affect your clients?
Yeah, you're right. Been a total disaster. I'm going to put, or can I give you a Wall Street Journal article to put in your show notes? There was just one out recently about this. So I would say that one big thing is a lot of people didn't complete it like they would have before. And in this article, it says as of March 1st, 29% have filled it out versus a typical 45%. So a lot of families were just like, I'm not going to do it. It's too much of a disaster. So I would say for a lot of my families, you know, they're trying to hold out for their awards. Some institutions, in particular the privates, are giving merit award without, you know, waiting for the FAFSA. So that's been helpful for families. One thing that's been difficult, I think, for everyone is campus housing. This is the time of year where people are saying you should commit so that you can put your housing deposit down, you know, the scare of we're going to run out of housing. And that's been hard for people to kind of worry about that. But a lot of families, I feel like, are just trying to do the best they can and make their decisions, you know, and being patient. But potentially they may end up going ahead with an offer that they already have without waiting for that decision. Let's hope it's better next year. It has really been a disaster this year.
You just mentioned the costs once you're in college. And yes, FAFSA, the disaster that it is not helping us feel confident that we can afford certain colleges. But then I also want to explore the other expenses, the expenses just to get in. Earlier, you had mentioned test prep as being potentially thousands of dollars if you're going to go there. Can you itemize for us other expenses associated with the college search process, application fees, other things? Can you, even just a ballpark would be fine.
Yeah. So typically the application fees and then the testing is where you see most of the money. And so application fees can literally be free up to about $100. And the average is about $50 for an application. So this kind of goes back to how many schools are you going to apply to? But, you know, if you do 10 schools at $50, you know, you're at $500. And so that can be expensive. The ACT is like $68 every time you take it. And then there's different things that you can do. Like you can, three times a year, you can get your test results. You pay separately for that. And then one thing that is a little, I don't want to say sneaky, but a little difficult with the ACT is you can have your test scores sent for free to four schools, but you have to choose that before you get your results. So some families aren't confident about doing that ahead of time. So instead they wait till they see the result and then send it, and you have to pay, it's about $20 for each school, each result. So that can add up as well to be quite a lot. But I would say other than those two things, the application fees and the testing, the rest of it is really if you want to do like a college consultant like I am, or you want to do like a test prep. And some people, like I said, will do that just because they think it's worth the return, because their student will end up getting either a scholarship or maybe into an institution that they didn't think that they would before. So you get that.
You mentioned that you got some students into Reach schools. So now I'm feeling pretty confident in your abilities. Can families use their 529 funds for these expenses?
So no, which is really a little frustrating because, well, in general, I would say no. Again, 529 rules are always a little crazy to me because I always find that it depends on who you ask. And we had 529 for our own kids. And so I did a little bit of investigation about it. And my understanding is that, you know, while they're in high school right now, which also changed in the last, what, 4 or 5 years, that you can only use 529 for tuition for high school. And then if it's a private institution, and then it's really meant to be for expenses once they get to college. And so, you know, that's room and board and tuition and things like that, but it's after they've already started. And so I do think this is an expensive part. You know, the ACT will have fee, like there is a fee waiver program, but it's really tied to very low income. And so it's similar to like free and reduced lunch in school. You know, if you're in that category, you can definitely get waivers, which will help with the testing as well as application fees. Most institutions will have that as well. But kind of for everybody else, you have to sort of expect to incur this cost for application fee and for testing.
Okay, well, how about on your taxes? Can you get a tax break? Can you claim this as legitimate educational expenses?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a good question. I don't know. I would think so, you know, because it is a legitimate educational expense. The difficulty is it's a college expense, but it's while you're in high school.
Right. So ask your tax preparer, your accountant. Yeah. All right. That's fair. And I would imagine some people just can't afford to hire a consultant to help them navigate the college search. And so for those students and families, what are your top recommendations in the search process to maximize their effort? Maybe you have three words of advice or can boil it down for us.
So there's a lot of families that I know who don't hire a consultant, you know, and do just fine for sure. I would say that the parents are extremely involved, you know, in that process. One thing I would say is use your library, get some books out about the college admissions process, get out an ACT, SAT prep book. You know, there's lots of things that have resources at the library that you can use. So definitely do that or purchase a book. You know, obviously that's not going to be as expensive as using a consultant. But you really have to keep on top of the process. So, you know, you have to follow the timeline, make sure that you're not doing things too late in the process. And so that can just take a lot of extra work. But as long as somebody's sort of paying attention to it, whether it's the student or the family member, that should work. My biggest piece of advice in general for the whole process is going to sound really funny, that students need to read their emails. So many.
Maybe that's a life lesson for all of us. Just read your emails. I send it to you in an email. People say that to me daily, and I'm like, huh.
Well, and my kids, like I said, are this age. I have one out of college and two in college, and I feel like they're so text savvy versus email savvy. But there's everything that the institution's going to do about your admissions comes through email. And I mean, every year you hear horror stories of students who like missed the deadline, missed all kinds of stuff because they didn't read it in their email. So that's I know it sounds silly, but it's really like the most important thing to keep track of everything through your email.
How long does this process take? What is your advice for when to start?
So you're going to laugh at this, but when I answer, I actually start a lot with eighth graders, believe it or not. And that's so that I can help make sure that they're on track with their college prep courses through their high school years. So I will meet with eighth and ninth and 10th graders, not a lot, maybe, you know, once or twice a year, just to make sure everything's going okay, making sure they're on track with their classes. And then around this time, you know, spring of junior year is really when I get started with students. And that's because I want to spread it out and make sure that we have enough time to work really well all the way through the application process. But my goal is that everything's pretty much done by August 1st when the Common App opens. Then we finalize everything and ideally apply in the fall on those early decision dates. And so it works well for a lot of families because they tend to have more time in summer. So we can do a lot in that summer between junior and senior year. But I know it sounds silly. The average applicant's going to submit everything almost by the time they start senior year, which is sort of amazing when you think about it. It means that most of what that colleges are looking at are just from your first 3 years.
Angela, I would not have been surprised if you had said we have to start in preschool. So I'm pleasantly surprised that I can wait until eighth grade because I have a sixth grader and a fourth grader, and I actually thought I was probably already too late.
You're good.
As we wrap up today, what's your best advice for college leaders to operate a viable institution? You've been in higher ed a long time. You've seen a lot of things. So your advice could be related to the college search process, but it could be related to anything.
Well, the number one thing that I think you and I hear through your podcast, as well as what we talked about today, is the question of, is the cost worth it? So institutions have to really be able to answer that question, you know, that what they're doing and the preparation they have for students to move on after their college experience and get a good job is important. And so I just think, you know, making sure there's enough investment in those resources, career resources, and what they're advertising for what students do at their institution is going to prepare them for that. So I think just, you know, making sure they can answer that question about the cost being worth it. In terms of kind of other suggestions for leaders, one thing I learned a long time ago is that the two most important things regarding retention is the fit of a student and the faculty and their interactions with students. So if those are the two things that really make a huge difference, that has to be important, not only at admissions time, but all the way through. So just making sure that institutions are kind of hiring for that, hiring student life and faculty to make sure it fits the culture and it fits kind of what they're selling to students. And so I say, you know, selling with quotes, because it's not a product, but it is an experience. And so making sure that it fits correctly and that they're, that institutions are putting their money kind of where they need to for that fit.
Angela, thank you so much for being here today. And I know some listeners are going to want to reach out to you and learn more about you and your work. I'll be sure to include your LinkedIn profile and website in the show notes, as well as that Washington Post article. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
To support the cause of the affordable college experience, visit us at highlevelleadership.com. Read our blog and join our email list to get connected. Follow us and leave a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Let's get down to college business.